whatever. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQYO.
Alright.
Well, what you just stated is the correct wisdom. But the reality of doing that is somewhat new. If you've got unbelievable wear on your front set of tires, and you don't have it on your rear set of tires, you better get your front end looked at, make sure that it's properly aligned. And if you do what I do, is I rotate my tires. Every time I change my oil, I get, the tires really are supposed to last about 40, 50,000 miles. I get about 85 to 90,000 miles on a set of tires, and I change them all. So, but that's just what I do. Back to you, Dick.
And while you're at it, I'll bet you change your oil every 2,500 miles. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, don't forget, I have a hybrid. I use, I use 5W20. I know about your story of changing your oil every 20,000 or 30,000 miles, but, I change it every 5,000 miles. I've got 160,000 miles on the car now, and the oil looks like it's brand new.
Okay, Bernie, recognize, I'm going to go to you in a second. What Eric is referring to is that I'm one of those rare people that has a lot of flack every time I change oil. I insist they put in 30-weight, non-multi-grade oil. But that's me. Bernie, K2YO, go right ahead.
A comment on the changing the tires. Once again, read your instruction manual with the vehicle. Some vehicle warranties will be voided if you do not change all the tires. Specifically, ones that have automatic two-wheel, four-wheel drive, they will actually void the warranty. If you've got a 100,000-mile warranty from the factory on it, sometimes they'll void that if you don't follow the correct changing all four tires at once. Not entirely sure why, but I know that to be true. Also, on your oil thing, I don't disagree with you, Dick. I'm not sure about the viscosity of the oil, but the amount of time to change the oil. My vehicle actually, the factory spec, after the break-in period, I think they change the oil the first time at like 3,000 or 4,000 miles. The next time they change it is at 50,000 miles.
What vehicle and what kind of oil are they recommending it be changed at 50,000? That sounds very unusual, Bernie. Go ahead.
It's a 3 Series BMW. It's an inline 6, and it's BMW oil. I don't know who makes their oil for them.
Do you believe that oil is a synthetic? Go ahead.
I know that it is a synthetic.
50,000. Wow. Yeah, I use 30-weight oil in the winter and the summer. And there's a whole bunch of theories as to why I do that, why I've been doing it for the last 30 years. I really don't believe in multi-grade oil, but that's just me. And that's the sludge that you get if you don't change the oil often enough. It comes from the coagulant that gives you the multi-grade function. And I don't like the multi-grade function. And it's not really required if you're not living in Alaska, in my opinion. But not everyone will agree with me on that one. I'm alone. I get a lot of flack from whatever mechanic I go to change my oil. Alrighty, we've got into an exciting subject tonight, and the bottom line of this is instruct everybody you know. If you've got a runaway engine, think ahead of time. Ignition into turn off, or transmission into neutral. And which one do you do first? There's a toss-up on that one. And it probably is a function of what vehicle brand and what model number is the best one. It is my strong belief that every rational design of automobile, no matter how fast you're moving, when you command it to go from drive to neutral, it will go to neutral. That's my strong belief. Until somebody brings me some pretty strong evidence to the otherwise. And if so, it's going to be some particular crazy design. Neutral has to be neutral. No matter what speed you're going from drive into neutral, it's got to go to neutral. If it doesn't, boy, that's a lawsuit in my opinion. And even if that is true, turning off the key is the next thing. But be careful about turning off the key. On some vehicles, there's a slim chance if you're too enthusiastic, turning off the key and you go two clicks back, you might get it into the steering lock position. That ain't good. And if at worst you do, be ready to turn the key back on one click to get it out of the lock condition. So there's some skill required here and a lot of forethought. Because if you wait until the panic situation occurs, and I suspect that we're going to be hearing more and more stories that each person that it happened to, they thought his condition is unique. It's like a person in college who had a date rape situation. She thinks it's unique, she thinks no one will believe it, and she doesn't report it. All of a sudden she finds out the three other girls dating the same guy had the same experience, and all of a sudden they get together and say, wow, we got to stop this guy. Well, the same thing can happen with cars. There's a number of people who have had a runaway engine, and they think it was unique to them, and they didn't report it. We're slowly discovering it ain't so unique. And because it is so darn life-threatening, we've got to discuss it, we've got to spread the word. That to prepare your friends ahead of time, what they're going to do, when it happens, and the brakes, quite possibly, is there a high probability that once you're in that situation, the brakes are not the right solution. Go ahead and try to use them, but don't go into the pure panic mode just because the brakes didn't work. Be ready to do the next two backups. And with any further questions or comments on the subject, give me a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2APG.
Heard N2APG and another person. Who was that other person?
K2YIY.
Okay, a very weak K-A-2-Y-I-Y. Yankee, India, Yankee is what it sounded like. Dave first. Go ahead, Dave. N2APG.
Okay, Dick. I didn't get a chance to finish up on the tire thing. I just, what I wanted your opinion on is that when I went online and searched around about tires and replacing them and stuff like that, a couple of websites suggested that if you are only replacing one set of the tires, that you put the good tires, the best tires, on the rear of the car, not on the front. And that was contrary to what I commonly believe. And the argument being that the tread depth, all right, in other words, you have your best, your new tires on the back of the car. The argument being that that is going to resist hydroplaning, and if you're going to have a hydroplaning situation, you'd rather hydroplane with the front tires versus the rear tires.
That seems to make some sense, because if you hydroplane and lose traction on the rear tires, the car will fishtail, and you quite possibly do a 180 or a 360 at high velocity. That's not good. If you hydroplane on the front wheels, you plow, you don't do a 180 in general, but you don't have steering. That still can get you in trouble. Since the front wheels have a greater weight on them because of the engine, the probability of them hydroplaning is a little bit less. So I'm with you. If you're only going to replace two, I do like the idea of the best tires on the rear and the not-so-best tires on the front. I think I agree with that one. Back to you, Dave, for any further comment.
Okay, well, I'm still, you know, I'm not sure which is the best. I'm just, you know, bringing the information out. That was the argument on the website, exactly what you mentioned. And they tested it on a skid track. They actually put a vehicle through its paces with bad tires on the front versus bad tires on the back. And the results were that if you hydroplaned with the front tires, most people would let off on the gas, would be fairly easy to recover from the skid, and you're okay. If you hydroplane on the back tires, just as you mentioned, majority of times the driver would lose control, the vehicle would skid and spin and most likely have a crash. So that's their argument, that if you're only replacing one set of tires, put the best tires on the back, regardless of whether the vehicle's front wheel or rear wheel drive. And I was always taught, well, it's front wheel drive. You want your best tires on the front for braking, for traction and for steering.
I think I heard a very weak K2MV and you're on the list. Yep. I see the argument and I think I agree with it. You're a man of proper resources, Dave, and the best of all solutions is to replace all four. But then the other half of the Dave I know is an economic guy. All hams are. Hams are frugal. Maybe I can say they're cheap. And so you don't buy things if you don't really have to. And so I'm with you. I'd put the best tires on the rear. And the demonstration that you were aware of on a skid track seems to confirm that. It's not an ideal solution, but it's the best of the solutions if you're not replacing all four. I'm going to go with that one. The next person was John, K-A-2-Y-I-Y. And I used to live in Farmingdale, John. That was my hometown, way back in the dark ages. You've got it, John, K-2-L-I-W.
Hi, this is Chris. I have a question on a completely unrelated topic.
Okay, you could use quite a bit more audio, and I'm going to be listening to you on the input because you're a little bit noisy into the machine. Before we go to you, John, on a different topic, let's pick up the other person who was quite weak, but I think it was K2MV, K2 Mike Victor, or something that sounds like that. Go right ahead, start off with your name, sir, and wait for the beep. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, I heard a transmission, but it was 97% noise. You're going to have to move to a different position or do something to correct the noise. Give it one more try. I'll listen on the input also.
Okay, how is this? This is K2MU.
Tremendous improvement. Go ahead, Bernie.
A big difference a couple inches makes with the HT. Okay, I just had a verified, very interesting. I'm driving a Honda Civic, which, unless I put on very good water, aqua tires, the higher-end tires, this car, when I first bought it, would slide like crazy as soon as there were a few drops of water on the ground. I couldn't believe it. So I put on the better tires, and it's fine. But it's interesting, this conversation, actually, I can verify that it is better to have the good tires in the back. Right now, I have four of these Aqua, whatever they're called. Different companies have different names of them, Aqua Treads, whatever, especially water-rated treads. With the deeper grooves or whatever, and I have new tires in the front and the old tires that really should be replaced, I had to have in the back. And I have noticed that the traction is horrible. I couldn't believe it. I actually did do a spin out at about maybe 15, 20 miles an hour. I thought I was going to crash. It was a miracle. I didn't. The back of the car just spun out. And that would be the kind of thing that would have happened on just regular tires. So I was actually kind of perplexed. I know I need new tires, and I couldn't believe how bad the traction was, though. And listening in on this conversation explains it to me. I have the bad tires in the back. I have tires that should have been replaced a while ago on the back. I'm figuring they're not as important in the back, and new tires went on the front. And it ain't a good situation. Like I say, the Civic is very sensitive to the tires, and I can just verify from personal experience. And now I know what's going on. I'm just taking it real slow and easy until I replace them. But it seems to, from my personal experience, you guys just explained to me what happened to me a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, we're all slowly getting a little bit smarter, Bernie. I think there's a place on the internet called Tire Rack, or something like that, that my son has gone to often every time he buys tires, where they do some pretty fancy ratings of tires. Back in the old days, the people who really wanted very good wet traction would buy a Dutch tire called Vredesteen, made of a very soft rubber. The good news is it gave you the best possible traction on a wet day. Had a good tread, soft rubber, really hugged the road. But you didn't get a whole lot of mileage out of it. I think the tires wore out in 25 or 30,000 miles. Nowadays, people like a much harder rubber where the tire treated correctly is going to go to 80,000 miles. But there's a bit of a trade-off there between hardness of rubber and wet weather traction. And there's another great big variable as to how they set up the tread itself, how deep, the scientificness of the grooves, which direction the grooves aim. There's a whole lot of science and art to hydroplaning and avoiding hydroplaning of tires. So we've come a long way. You buy the right tire and drive it correctly, I think you can get darn good wet weather traction, reasonably good snowy weather traction, and reasonably good mileage without spending a fortune. But there are some tires that if you spend more money, do give you more of all of the above. Seems to be true in some cases. So I'm far from a tire expert. My son is a lot more knowledgeable because he studies those websites where some of these ratings take place. Like everything else, you can vote with your wallet and do a lot of education on the subject. Okay, so the bottom line is instruct all your friends to not panic when that engine runs away. You've got two other lines of defense. And don't just sit there standing on the brakes and hope the car's going to slow down and run out of gas. Enough people have gotten into a lot of trouble that we know what's happening. The rug on the floor of the car is a strong causative agent. It may not be the only one. It was Lou that brought to our attention that the rug had already been removed from the car that went into the runaway engine condition and created an accident, a life-threatening situation. So there's more to the story, and it's going to take a while before all the smoke has settled. Reminds me a little bit about the Ralph Nader situation where he wrote his book on Unsafe at Any Speed. He came to the conclusion that a Corvair automobile, simply because of the way it was set up with 60% of the weight in the rear and 40% in the front, that it was unsafe. Well, there's a lot more going on. He didn't realize it, but an awful lot of those overturned vehicles were because of a missing cotter pin. I had that vehicle. That cotter pin fell out, and if it didn't happen in a parking lot when I was only moving 5 miles an hour, I would have turned over that vehicle, and it was a convertible, and quite possibly the TechNet wouldn't have sounded the same. Alrighty, let's see what John's got to say. He's got a slightly different subject. That's okay. As long as it's of interest to ham radio, John. KA2YIY, K2RIW.
Hi, Dick and the net. I do a lot of monitoring of the Republic Tower and TRACON. I've noticed that with the aircraft radios, it's usually not a squelched tail on the signal. I'm wondering what they do differently from us in the ham world.
Back in the old days, Motorola had something called anti-squelch. Back in the days when the PL tone was done with a reed, 136.5 hertz resonant reed, the transmitting radio would leave the carrier on. When you release the push-to-talk button, the radio would keep the carrier on for a certain number of seconds. It would continue to transmit the PL tone of 136.5 at 180 degrees out of phase. It would suddenly reverse the phase of the PL tone. That in turn would damp out the mechanical reed relay that was looking for 136.5. It would stop it from vibrating. The lack of the vibration would tell the receiver, hey, there's no PL tone there, and it would turn off the audio. But it's turning off the audio at a time the carrier is still present, so it's turning off the audio at a time when the receiver is quiet. So the anti-PL tone, or the bucking PL, whatever it was called, is the way it was done then. I am guessing with modern-day digital radios, there is the equivalent, a digital code of some kind that's like PL, and if the radio turns off the PL first, before it stops transmitting and leaves in carrier, you'll get a quiet squelch tail. That's my guess. Now, Eric does an awful lot of maintenance of our repeaters. He probably knows what's really going on. KE2EJ, you might have an opinion on this one. K2RIW.
Dick and 2EO, that's called reverse burst, and I have it downstairs with a ComSec unit.
Very good. Let's see if Eric's got a word on that, and if Eric's not available, we'll go over to Rich next. Eric first.
Okay, what was your question?
We're finding out about reverse burst. Turns out John is saying, how can the modern-day radios, particularly the TRACON radios that are used at the FAA site, how do they get such a quiet squelch tail? And I am speculating that some digital form of reverse burst is probably what they're doing. Over to you, Eric.
No, there's all sorts of squelch tail cancellations. But the easiest way to do it, and which we don't, by the way, I could, is just simply to delay the audio and kill it before the squelch tail happens.
Does it matter that they're on AM?
I don't think so. Yes, all FAA is essentially AM. But the disadvantage of putting in another delay is that for the kind of operation we've got right now, it would be more difficult. I can remember when this repeater did have delay, I listened to what's coming back out of the repeater, and I had to learn how to keep talking when I heard my own voice coming back a third of a second delay. And that takes training. For the first hour or so, you go into stuttering. So for a bunch of reasons, I guess you'd like to not have to do that bucket brigade audio delay circuit if you didn't have to. Is that roughly what's going on here, Eric? You got it, Eric?
Yeah, if you remember, that delay board had pretty lousy audio quality, so I just got rid of it. Actually, GE has a method of what they call channel guard. It uses a little pilot signal to tell it when to open and close, and essentially you get no squelch noise. And then, of course, there's really fast squelching action, and there's a lot of different methods. Different manufacturers have different ways of doing it. But all you need is like 2 or 3 milliseconds, 200 or 300 milliseconds worth of delay, and a switch, and you're all set to go. I mean, I could do that here, but I just simply don't.
Yeah, and even only a third of a second delay of hearing my voice coming back, it's kind of hard to live with. There are times when I transmit on the 147.375, but listen on 2585, and depending on the particular hookup you get through the internet, with your linking of those two repeaters, there are times when you get, what, 3, 4, 5 seconds of delay. That really takes training. I wonder if you've ever tried talking when your own voice is coming back 3, 4, or 5 seconds delayed. And by the way, is that about the longest delay you've ever heard by the, I think it's called IRLP? Back to you, Eric.
Depends on the day, Dick. Depends upon what the available path is. You know, the path can go, the whole point of what the military designed when this was called DARPANET. The idea is that you can have a failure in any one of the nodes and your data will find its way to where it's going. So, you know, I think 5 seconds is a bit excessive. I haven't really noticed it being that long. But in broadcasting, we go up the satellites and back, and that can really add up fast. And that's why we do things like mixed minuses, so that when the person that is speaking, say in Iraq or somewhere else, doesn't hear themselves come back, because that would make them absolutely crazy. But they do have to hear what's going on in the studio in New York. So, you know, that's something broadcasters have had to deal with for ages.
Very good. When you get the long delay on the IRLP linking between the two repeaters on Long Island, is it because our particular link, I'm going to exaggerate a little bit here, is going all the way to Australia and back? What do you think is creating that number of seconds of delay, Eric? Go ahead.
All right, first of all, when you think the way we do it, I mean, we could, in fact, hook up Selden to Glen Oaks directly, but that would preclude anyone else from getting into it from anywhere else. That would mean the two repeaters would be locked to each other, and anybody that wanted to call in from the outside is not going to happen. What we do is we actually make a connection between Glen Oaks and Boston, and we make another connection between Selden and Boston, and in Boston is something called a reflector, which essentially has no audio there. It just simply directs data, and Like when I flew from Las Vegas or Huntington Beach, California, hook up during the TechNet, they're essentially making their connection to Boston. So how it gets from Glen Oaks to Boston, well, I mean, I could do a trace route and give you the exact path, but you can figure that it's going through Time Warner, through their hub. They, in turn, make a connection into somebody else's long haul, which makes its way up to Boston, which goes through from the long haul company to the short haul company into the reflector, which is actually is part of an ISP's facility. And from there, it'll go back into a short haul, into a long haul, and find its way out to Sheldon. In that case, it's via Verizon. It may actually come through the trans, the underwater cable that runs between Stanford and Port Jefferson. There's a lot of different paths it could possibly take, including satellites. So each time you make a connection, there's a good chance it's not getting connected the same way. K2RW, K2J.
W2RYY. Joe recognized. You just gave me at least two questions, Eric. Number one, are some of those long delay paths, do you think we're going through a satellite? Number two, I hear a tremendous amount of variability as to what particular link you get when you decide to do a hookup a particular hour of a particular day. How do you end up not having a double link simultaneously? The reason I'm asking that is on three occasions I have heard on digital television what I call double audio.
You're going to try it out, Jake.
Okay. Explain to me the double audio that I've heard on digital television. How often do you think we're running into a satellite link? And I'd love to know how secure the system is during wartime if various portions of the system gets knocked out. Do we still have a reasonable, reliable system? Answer any of the above. You got it, Eric.
All right. Well, as far as, the Internet goes, the whole concept of the TCP/IP protocol is that if it's got an address and it's got a destination address, it's going to find its way there. All the hubs are essentially all interconnected to each other like the spokes of a wheel. So if any one particular hub drops dead, it'll find a path to another. So that's one issue. Actually, I worked on a project that was for the Defense Department where we actually made these little silver balls that would be, I don't even know if I should be talking about it, but we made these little silver balls that could be dropped out of an airplane. Each one of them was, let's call it a Wi-Fi packet repeater. And so the enemy could, try and smash as many of those balls as you wanted, but because of the inherent nature of the TCP/IP protocol, it would find its way to wherever it was going as long as you dropped enough of these balls around. Now, what are you talking about in terms of verbal audio in digital television? Be more specific.
On two or three occasions, when listening to Channel 50 from New Jersey, I heard what I call double audio. That is to say, there were two audio channels running simultaneously, delayed by 100 milliseconds, 50 milliseconds, more than enough delay to be annoying, but you could still, with difficulty, figure out what was being said. And it went on for an hour at a time. I even briefly heard it on one of the PBS stations in New York, but I've heard it on two or three occasions in New Jersey. Over to you.
Are you talking about the difference between left and right channel or audio with a delayed audio on the same, coming out of the same speaker?
The second. I was almost positive my television receiver was running in the mono mode, but there I'm not sure. But the audio really was double. It's as if somebody was running main audio and backup audio. They were both playing through simultaneously, and they were slightly displaced in time. Go ahead.
Okay, now one really important question. Did you try tuning away from the channel and then tuning back to it?
Yea, verily. Tuned away and turned back two or three times. It was there for a solid hour. Go ahead.
Okay, remember we at Channel 21 had an issue which turned out to be a satellite receiver that was, the computer kind of lost its mind, so it was actually repeating packets. And I think in another situation there was an encoder problem. So the fact that we experienced those problems doesn't preclude that another station somewhere else wouldn't have similar problems if they were using similar equipment. Also, DVB, which is the DVBS, which is actually the format that's used on the satellites, and by the way, that's what the Ohio hams use for amateur television, a very simple form of it. You can run into things like that. It isn't intentional, it isn't deliberate, but sometimes it takes a little bit of smarts to realize that it's happening, and even a little more smarts to figure out where it's coming from.
Because Channel 50 from New Jersey is also a PBS channel, 50-1 and 50-2, there's probably a high probability they're using similar equipment to your equipment. Is that true, Eric?
Oh, no, I can tell you precisely. It's a Sencor 4960 satellite receiver, which was actually distributed throughout the entire PBS system. There's been about, up to this point, I think maybe about 12 software upgrades. The last major upgrade actually had the AFD flag, which actually tells its automatic format descriptor. You know, stuff is all computer-based. VLSI circuitry actually is in software, whereas, you know, these FPGAs that get loaded when you turn them on, they become circuits, so... you know, you're talking about cars with computers. That's why, actually, when we talk about the computer in a car, it's not a computer. There's one sort of housekeeping computer, another one that's dedicated to firing off the spark plugs, another one that's dedicated to making the transmission do the right thing. I know, like, in my car, there's 12 microprocessors. They're all doing specifically different things. And you don't realize it, but the cruise control buttons and everything, they use something called a LIN bus, which is essentially one wire. So every time you have a bunch of buttons on the door, you actually got a tiny little microprocessor sending out a serial stream. So count those, the microprocessor count goes way up. But, and as Bernie can tell you, writing software is sometimes not the easiest thing in the world. And in the case of this stuff, it's firmware. So it's even more complicated than if you were just trying to create a database.
BY, can you give me a couple minutes, Dick?
Sure, Ken. We should say a few words to Joe, who's been waiting patiently. Good information. I've got a lot more questions for you, Eric, but I'm going to stop for now. Joe, to B2RYY, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, the question I have is very simple, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. This is for KE2EJ. Is there a delay going to the IROP node that is in Glen Oaks? In other words, if somebody dekeys on the 2-meter receiver, does that COS line, or what you would call it, drop immediately, or does that go through a controller that adds a delay to it?
You got it, Eric.
I think my ears are not doing too well with them. Repeat the question for me.
Joe, you're going to have to repeat that question. Go ahead, Joe.
The question was, does the IRLP node up in Glen Oaks have a delay going between the 2-meter receiver and the COS line to the node? Is there any kind of delay going through any kind of controller, or does the COS line track the receiver instantaneously?
I gotcha. There is a slight delay, but it's only it's less than a millisecond, so there's nothing to speak of. Essentially, it's getting its instructions from the repeater controller, which is in there, which is actually an ARM processor. And that is then going into a PC, which then actually sends out over a port in the TCP protocol the fact that it's active. But because of the nature of the system, it takes time, but when it gets to the other end, so that little bit of path loss time, or that latency that occurs, gets added to the time that it takes for that COS to arrive at the
other site that it's controlling and then activate its thing. But for all practical purposes, there's really no delay between the COS line and the IRLP computer.
Okay. The reason I ask this is because I've heard this system time out the reflector several times during one TechNet, and it will actually disconnect everybody off the reflector when it happens. That's what made me ask this question, because my node doesn't do it.
Okay, and the reason for that happening is because the timeout timer on the IRLP is fixed, and I have no way to manipulate it, and it's consistent throughout the entire system. So, actually what I've got to do, what I should have done a while ago, is delay the beep. So that way people wait a little more, and if they wait a little more, the whole system will recycle. So the COS line drops immediately when you drop it here. But let's say the path to the reflector is 2 seconds, okay? Somebody picks it up before then, it doesn't leave enough space and time. The IRLP machine, as far as it's concerned, will time out, and the connection to Sheldon or whoever may happen to be listening to the reflector, they're going to get disconnected.
Okay, when I understand that the COS is active on any node, and probably includes a reflector, more than 4 minutes continuously, it'll knock you off. That's what made me ask this question in general, if there's any kind of time delay, because I've heard people drop it, I've heard the courtesy tone go out, which theoretically would cause the COS line to go low and then go high again, or whichever way you're making it activate, and it still will time out the reflector and dump everybody off the reflector. That's what's a little puzzling.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you listen to, like, if you dial up, you obviously are familiar with IRLP, so anytime you dial up, say, the Las Vegas reflector, they will say, please wait 2 seconds before speaking, and that's to compensate for the latency in the path.
Okay, here's the last question for you. Have you ever remotely monitored the COS line while a TechNet is running? I know you can do that by activating read input if you know how to do that. Have you ever done that?
Actually, I do. And I can also drive the line high. I can drive the line low here from my computer here. But then again, I have the latency between where I am and the computer up there. But when I've been up at the site, you know, I look and see what's going on. And I see how the IRLP reacts. And I kind of kept the beep just at the hairy edge. It's really a little bit too short. It needs to be another 500 milliseconds later. And I think that baloney will stop. But then again, there are people who don't let it drop long enough. So, you know, people will pick it up and pick it up. And as far as the COS and the IRLP are concerned, it sees it as one continuous COS. Because there is a little bit of delay in terms of the COS dropping as far as, like, when a carrier drops, I think it takes, the way I have the controller set, it actually hangs on to it for another 250 or 300 milliseconds before it actually forces the line low.
Okay, well, that's causing the timeout then, apparently.
Yeah, well, what I got to do is I got to force the beep to be a little bit later, and if people behave. See, normally, if you listen to the repeater during the day and people are having their conversation as opposed to the net, the only time that it will actually drop out is when we're doing this net, because everybody jumps on each other.
Okay, understood. I tried getting in early to be our IRLP. It was totally impossible, so I had to come home and get on the input directly into meters. Okay, over to the next guy. To be to where I want.
Very fine, Joe. Mel, I know that last week we were promising to start going to the mailbag a little bit earlier, so we don't have as many people angry with you not getting answers. Well, we got on a hot and heavy subject tonight with automobile accelerator pedals being stuck. Sorry about that. K2KEY, K2RIW with Julie.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Got from Julie a text message. Going to sleep, got to get up in the morning, go to work. All right, anyhow, no, yeah, I'm getting a lot of flack with this, I'm trying to answer some of these emails, but It's a little too overwhelming, Dick, and I'm getting a lot of flack that no use bothering with you guys anymore with emails. Gotten that several times already. But all right, one of the emails, I shouldn't say one, a number of the emails are from last week. We misled, I don't know, inadvertently we misled people, but there seems to be a lot of confusion. And it started out basically with a person that came on and said that they wanted to buy a linear amplifier, but their tuner only was capable of handling up to 250 watts. And then the discussion was it worth buying a linear amplifier that they could only go from the 100 watt to maybe add another 100 watt to the amplifier in that situation, and, you know, about purchasing it and laying out that kind of money. And, of course, we explained that it wouldn't make very much difference in a signal just adding 100 watts. Let me let it drop, and I'll tell you where the controversy came up. For some reason, there's been a misunderstanding. They think that if you buy a new linear amplifier, solid-state linear amplifier, that you do not need, if you up to now have to use an external antenna tuner of some sort, that with the solid-state, because you do not have to tune the amplifier, that it automatically makes it an amplifier that you will not have to use that external tuner anymore. Even though I know some of the linear amplifiers, the more solid-state ones, do have a built-in tuner, but they are under the misunderstanding that just because you go solid-state, that means you do not need an antenna tuner anymore if you were previously using it to operate your exciter, your transceiver. Take over.
I certainly see how this confusion can take place. In the case of a no-tuned final amplifier for a transmitter, where the final stage is solid state, and it's designed for a 50-ohm resistive load, and hopefully if you've done a real good job, your antenna looks like a 50-ohm resistor with no reactants. In that case, the final stage of that transistorized amplifier draws the right amount of current, has the right resonant frequency, everything's hunky-dory. As you start creating any amount of reflected power from the antenna, as you start creating any amount of standing wave ratio above 1:1, to some degree that final stage transistor is going to become unhappy. Depending on the phase angle of the reflection, that's a fancy way of saying, is your antenna off of 50 ohms by being capacitive reactive or inductive reactive? They're essentially 180 degrees out of phase, but you see what I mean. You've got a certain phase angle of reflected energy that tells you what the antenna is. Is it a capacitor? Is it an inductor? Is it high in impedance or low impedance? As you start mismatching that final amplifier, he's either going to get excessive voltage on his collector, RF voltage, because he's lightly loaded, and he's going to go into secondary breakdown, or he's going to go into one of the modes where he draws excessive current, and it creates excessive heating. For a whole bunch of reasons, if your amplifier is designed for 50 ohms resistor, let me drop, and it sees something else, the final stage is subject to being overheated, overvoltaged, and otherwise damaged. As such, most amplifiers will have a built-in circuit for protection that if it sees more than, I'll pick a number, 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, it goes into some kind of a self-protect mode, either turning itself completely off or going into a decreased power output. Automatic antenna tuner, if you're within the range, solves the problem. But whether the final stage be in your transmitter or the final stage be in your amplifier that you've added to the transmitter, you've got the exact same vulnerability. That final stage transistor, whether it be a separate amplifier or the amplifier that's in your transmitter, in either case you mismatch it, you're subject to damaging it if it doesn't have a protect circuit, or if it wasn't super conservative in its design. If the guy designed it for a kilowatt power transistor and he's only running it at 200 watts, well, maybe you can tolerate a dead short circuit. But for cost reasons, very few manufacturers will do that. So If you needed a tuner for your regular amplifier, I think you're 99% of the time going to need a tuner for your external solid-state amplifier. Tube amplifiers are a lot more forgiving on this, but solid-state, they've got a number of quirks where they're not very tolerant of strong mismatch. That's the way I see it. Wonder how you see it, Mel. K2KE1, K2RIW.
Let me make it a bottom line. If you needed some kind of a tuner, whether it be an auto tuner or a mechanically adjusted tuner, to operate into your antenna system as of before you purchased or thinking of purchasing the linear amplifier, it will be the same condition. In other words, if your tuner is only rated at 250 watts and you're going to buy a kilowatt amplifier, you're going to have to replace the tuner with a tuner that's going to be able to handle the linear amplifier. You just cannot just forget about the tuner. Sophisticated solid state of them do have a built-in tuner. That's where the confusion is. Not all of them, so you have to check with the model that you're contemplating buying and find out if it has that built-in auto tuner. If it don't, you will have to purchase for even the solid state or the manually tuned amplifier. You will have to purchase a tuner. Either or, there's going to be a tuner required again if you previously have to have a tuner for your antenna system. I think that's the easiest way to state it, Dick. Basically, no magic with an amplifier because it's no tune, that it automatically eliminates your tuner, over.
Yep, I agree 100%. There is one more solution. We amateurs are smart enough to figure out if the antenna is not a, let me pick a number, 1.2 to 1 fanning wave ratio. If it's something higher than that, at that frequency, at least on that frequency, if not others, you can correct it by putting in a tuning stub, by correcting the antenna itself, by changing impedance of cable in funny places. There's a zillion ways you can make the antenna stop creating the grief. That's the other approach. That's the cheapest approach. With rare exception, correct the problem in the antenna. At least on that band where you've done the correction, you might not need an antenna tuner ever. Then again, if you're a good home brewing guy, making the antenna tuner is not too expensive. A little bit difficult to get the parts. To buy a high-power antenna tuner tends to be expensive. So that's the laziest, most expensive approach, is one way of looking at it. We've only got 1 or 2 minutes left. This was TechNet number 1,273. When you go to the...
At 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
When you go to the website that allows you to play back TechNets, amateurradio.tangovictor, last week's TechNet was not properly recorded. You won't be able to play it back from last week. That'll be corrected, don't worry. 73 you all, be kind to each other, and we'll be back with some hot subjects next week. You wait and see. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Good night, Gracie.
Okay, take care, everyone, and I'll try to answer some of their emails, which are, I can answer briefly, but the ones that are more detailed, I'll try. I will try to jam them in on further TechNet. 73's all. Have a nice week. This is K2KEY.
And once again, we've never promised to give a written consulting service answer. We've only promised on the air live answers to the best of our ability and the ability of all the other people that gather. You write us an email expecting to get a high-power answer, and you think you're the only person. 99% of the time, you're not the only one. We've never guaranteed that. You're taking the risk. You might not get an answer. You'll have to accept that risk when you write the letter. Repeating that message. 73 you all. Bye-bye for now.
K2RAW, WHYY. I should have some good power supply questions next week because I just acquired an LCR meter that I borrowed
to measure that choke I had a problem with a long time ago. Remember that one? It'll be coming up next week.
Sure do. That was a beauty. I've got to leave you for now, Joe. And you and I will eventually get together. Hang in there. Bye-bye for now.
WHYY.
Reflector 9126. Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
Shack TRS-80 computer with the Zilog Z80 80 chip. I started playing around with the subway language, and I got pretty good at it. In fact, I wrote, it started off, I wrote a little terminal program. Actually, I started by copying a terminal program that was in the Radio Shack manual that teaches you assembly language. And over about a year and a half, it grew into about 20 or 30 pages of assembly code. I never published it. I don't even have it anymore, but it was a packet radio program I wrote called T-Packet, T-P-A-C-K-E-T. It was a split-screen program for the TRS-80. By the time I got it done, everybody was on to the first of the PC computers. But then, you know, I just lost interest when I went to the higher languages, you know, like C, C++. I think in those days it was mostly Quick Basic. Not Basic, but Quick Basic. And I enjoyed writing in assembly. I don't know. For a while, I got a copy of MASN, Microsoft Assembler, and I wrote a few things, you know, little stuff on the first PC that I had.
Somebody who knows the difference between Basic and Quick Basic, and there was also what they called the Basic Compiler, and what MASAM is. You are a rare man now that you know what MASAM is, and I still know where my copy is. I've written more than a few pages. Dabbled in 6502 back when I wasn't so much a Z80 guy, and went from there. Rich, I gotta stop and get some fuel. Gas station's about a half a block ahead. I'll be on the side while fueling. KG2V.
Hey Charlie, I'll stand behind you, KG2